which was for this term, organised by the Centre for Cold War Studies. My name is Professor Mick Cox. I'm in the International Relations Department here at the LSE. I'm one of the co-directors of the newly established Cold War Studies Centre. And Professor Arne Westad from the Department of International History is the other co-director. Last week, we had Fred Halliday reflecting, reminiscing in the only ways that Fred could on the Cold War and the legacy. And I'm very pleased this evening to welcome my old friend, colleague at the moment at the LSE, Professor Richard Nedlebow, who is the James O. Friedman Presidential Professor of Government at Dartmouth College. Ned was, thank you, some patriots up there, Ned, so I'll make sure I won't ask him a question. Ned is educated at the University of Chicago, Yale, City University of New York. He's had an illustrious academic career, masses of publications, books and articles. Somebody even told me the other day he's got six manuscripts on about to go over the next 6 to 7 months. I hope this is untrue.
It's an exaggeration.
Okay, it's five. But anyway, but it says something about Ned's enormous productivity. He's written on ethnic conflicts. I remember first a lecture Ned gave, I think, in Northern Ireland when I used to live there back in the 1990s on that sort of question and issue of ethnicity. Ned has also written on the Cold War, and his recent book is essentially on the tragic vision of politics. And Ned also and myself attended a great small conference on Hans J. Morgenthau not very long ago. This evening, however, Ned is going to talk about world orders in chaos, from the Cold War to the War on Terror, to continue the kinds of questions that we've been asking in this particular series. So it gives me great pleasure to welcome Ned here to the LSE to talk to this particular subject. Ned, over to you.
Maybe you should hold your applause until you hear what I have to say.
They're very polite. They're good.
I'm going to really talk about the end of the Cold War and what we can learn from it, based on a book of which I am co-editor, along with Richard Herman of Ohio State University. It came out published by Palgrave in March of this past year, 2004. I'm going to address primarily the theoretical lessons of the end of the Cold War, because in an earlier book co-authored with Janice Stein, We All Lost the Cold War, I looked at the policy lessons, and in particular, the utterly... Is that a better mic?
Just hit them both.
Reminds me of the old days when Franklin Roosevelt would have a battery of six of these in front of him.
Just think of this as the House of Un-American Activities, and you're before the Senate Committee.
I didn't do it. I don't know them, and I'm not me.
You've never been a member of one either.
That book addressed the policy issues associated with the end of the Cold War, and in particular the outrageous triumphalist notion which prevails in the United States that somehow Ronald Reagan's Star Wars and defense budget brought the Soviet Union to its knees. This is, of course, I think the technical term for it is nonsense, but I'll address that later if people would like. But what's striking is the extent to which even liberals in the New York Times repeat this as if it's the accepted conventional wisdom. But tonight I'm going to talk more about the theoretical lessons and how we come to think about such a complex event as the end of the Cold War. How do we make sense about it? What can we learn that is relevant to our understanding of politics from it? Before doing this, I just want to say something on a personal note, that the Cold War has been with me for much of my life. I'm old enough to remember the beginning of it. I started school, alas, in 1946, so remember all of the events of the Cold War, and some of them, well, I was lucky. I came of age between the Korean War and the Vietnam War, so I missed service in either conflict. I was a graduate student when the Cuban Missile Crisis came along, of which I have, I think it's one of the few Cold War events of which I have fond memories, because I had just begun to date a girl who was convinced the world was going to come to an end. And I took full advantage of her fears.
believe. I'm going to leave the stage.
Now, of course, in the United States, I could never tell this story. It's just, with political correctness. Here, I think I can probably get away.
And
we'll see. And since the Cold War has ended, I have moved on to other topics, but I keep... academic topics. I keep getting dragged back into addressing it for either substantive, practical, well, I mean theoretical, or in this case, collegial reasons. So let me turn to why the Cold War ended. In thinking about this, we first have to ask ourselves, well, what do we mean by the end of the Cold War? It's not altogether obvious what that is. Some people, Hans Morgenthau among them, thought the Cold War had really ended sometime in the late 60s when the likelihood of a superpower war significantly declined. Other people think that the Cold War, in retrospect, some even said so at the time, ended with Helsinki, because the Cold War was fundamentally, at least in the beginning, a struggle over a territorial vacuum or political vacuum in Central Europe, which each of the superpowers sought to fill and came into conflict with one another in the process. Helsinki put an end to that with a recognition of the post-war territorial status quo. It's interesting, too, if you think about it, that much of the Cold War in the post-Helsinki phase and in what is sometimes called the mini Second Cold War under Ronald Reagan's first term in office was about threatening weapon deployments and, indeed, and third world conflicts. If you look at the history of the Cold War, the development and deployment of these weapons and the spread of that conflict to other parts of the world was a consequence of the underlying rivalry in Europe. Ironically, once that rivalry was ended, the conflict continued on its own. So what had initially been an effect of a cause became a cause in itself until the Cold War came to an end when nobody really expected it in the late 80s and early 90s. And we're going to zero in on that period because that's what our book focused on. But we do so with the understanding that that was not so much the end of the Cold War as the end of the end of the Cold War. That when Gorbachev came to power in January of 1986, Soviet-American relations, or East-West relations, if you will, had changed enormously before then. It's hard to imagine that somebody like Gorbachev could have come to power in an earlier period. The superpowers had worked out ways of living with each other that had reduced the threat of war. They had long-standing experience with arms control. They had reached, as I noted earlier, in the Helsinki Agreement, a acceptance of the territorial division arising in Europe from World War II. There were still conflicts that were very real, and Gorbachev worried would become more acute. But the superpowers also had ample experience in dealing with those conflicts. And perhaps most importantly of all, on the Soviet side, and at least in Europe and certainly among many American academics and journalists, there was a shared belief that the Cold War had become counterproductive, that its continuation risked the survival of the human race for very little in terms of national security on the part of either superpower. And that perception changed the nature of the game in important ways, and as I'll argue, allowed Gorbachev the space to make a series of what were, in fact, unilateral concessions in the hope of coaxing responses from the Western side. At one point, in an interview with Gorbachev in 89, and he repeated this when I spoke to him later, he said, you know, he said the peace movement was more important than NATO in ending the Cold War. He said Reagan, in his first term, made all kinds of frightening statements, but every time he did, there was an outcry on the part of public opinion. He was drawn back by Congress, by people in his own party. We knew that whatever military advantage the Americans had, there was no way they could exploit it. This created the political space for us to make the initiatives to extend the olive branch in ways that ultimately created political progress. So I'm going to be focusing here on the end of the Cold War. And it is something which I think has important lessons. And here I would like to disassociate myself from Robert Cohane, who at an earlier conference, I don't agree with Bob about much of anything. At an earlier conference, he attacked the very premise of the conference of learning from the end of the Cold War and dismissed it as a mere data point and argued that one data point, anybody who's a good social scientist and who's read King, Cohane, and Verbal would know that a mere data point doesn't mean anything. One of our graduate students stood up and said, "Well, sir, the Big Bang was a mere data point as well, a singularity, and the whole history of the universe is a function of what happened at the Big Bang, and if we don't study it, we can't understand who we are and where we're going. The end of the Cold War was a political Big Bang of the same way, and studying it is very important to us substantively and theoretically." And others pointed out that the end of the Cold War was a multitude of data points, all of which ended up in a pattern that has important meanings for how we think theoretically about the world. So with this end in mind, we sought to recruit scholars who represented differing points of view, rather than trying to promulgate a party line, so to speak, on how the Cold War ended. So we had people who were realist, constructivist, none of the above, and I'll tell you who they were in just a second. And we thought that they, in fact, were recruited because they were representatives of four major approaches to explaining the end of the Cold War. And the first of these is generally at the systemic level, and it can be described in terms of material capabilities. And realists, on the whole, argue that the imbalance in material capabilities, that the relative decline of the Soviet Union, made it a necessity for its leader, any leader, to seek an accommodation with the West in the hope of buying time to strengthen the Soviet Union and reemerge as a strong power. So this is the material capability slash realist explanation for the end of the Cold War. And in our book, William Wolfoth, now my colleague at Dartmouth, wasn't at the time, represents that point of view. And to a lesser extent, James Davis at the, he was at the Geschwister Scholl Institute in Munich. He now has the chair of international relations in St. Gallen. The second explanation is ideas. That it was really glasnost, perestroika, and new thinking about the Soviet Union's domestic situation and place in the world that led Gorbachev and those around him to extend the olive branch to the United States. And it was ultimately reciprocated on the American side, once again, because of changed ideas about the Soviet Union and American security. Certainly, ideas are associated with the constructivist approach to international relations, but they go beyond that to embrace liberals and others who see them as central drivers of world politics. The third explanation is domestic politics. And domestic politics can often explain a lot about the kinds of strategic choices and foreign policy choices that leaders and coalitions make. In our project, I should have noted that representatives of the ideas approach included Jacques Levesque, who is the, I suppose, leading authority on Soviet policy toward Eastern Europe, who teaches at the Université de Québec. And in part, George Breslauer, now Dean of Social Sciences at Berkeley, who has written extensively about leaders in domestic politics in the Soviet Union. The domestic politics argument was most strongly represented by Matthew Evangelista, who teaches at Cornell and has written a very fine book on Soviet and American arms control and the role of domestic politics in bringing this, and domestic structures in bringing it about. The fourth explanation is leaders. And clearly, leaders are important. One can entertain the notion, and I'll come back to this, that if there had been other leaders besides Gorbachev and Reagan, we might have had a very different result in the course of Soviet-American relations. So we had representatives from these differing traditions, and we brought them together because all of us believed that our own preferred approach cannot explain the end of the Cold War. That at best, it's a first entry into the problem, a way of organizing the situation. And one needs to take into account these other explanations to come up with convincing stories for what happened. And the interesting question and the theoretical challenge, rather than having the usual pissing match across the theoretical urinals, well, that was what much of academic argument is about, was instead to figure out a way of bridging theories and levels of analysis and coming up with more complex ways of thinking theoretically about events that almost by definition have complex causes. And we thought the way to do this was to identify key turning points in the end of the Cold War. And here we picked five turning points. I'll go through them briefly. I'll come back to them. The first was Gorbachev's election to General Secretary. Clearly a key moment in Soviet politics in retrospect. Secondly was the Soviet decision to withdraw from Afghanistan and more broadly from many of its third world commitments. Such a move helped establish Soviet credibility, and it created the space for Gorbachev to engage in domestic reforms and foreign policy initiatives. Thirdly was a breakthrough in arms control, east-west, over conventional forces and strategic forces, without which it seems an end of the Cold War would not have been possible. Number four was the enormous sea change in Eastern Europe. The de facto decision by the Soviet Union not to use the Red Army to maintain communist regimes in power, allowing the Soviet Union, as Foreign Minister Shevardnadze said, deliberately quoting Frank Sinatra, to let them do it their way. And finally, and as a result of these changes, the unification of Germany. If the division of Germany, de facto and then de jure, really represents the beginning of the Cold War, one cannot conceive of an end to the Cold War that didn't in some way solve the German problem, and none more fittingly, of course, than reunification. So the task we gave to our authors was to take these four competing theories and apply them to the five turning points and to see which of the theories or theories derived within these different paradigms, which of them would provide the most compelling explanation for your turning point, or which combination of them appeared to be most synergistic. Which combination of them appeared to be at odds or at cross purposes? And finally, how contingent was this outcome? Could you use counterfactuals to construct a different outcome? How much of context would you have to change to get a different outcome? And what would that say about the power of the respective explanations you were using? So Archie Brown from Oxford wrote the chapter on Gorbachev. The Richard Herman of Ohio State wrote the next chapter on the decision to withdraw from Afghanistan and the Third World more generally. Matthew Evangelista wrote the chapter on the arms control agreements. Jacques Lévesque on Eastern Europe. And a co-authored chapter on Germany was the last of the turning points, written by William Wolforth and James Davis. There were three other chapters, or there are three other chapters in the book, and I'll come to them in a moment. One by George Breslauer and yours truly on counterfactual explorations. A concluding theoretical chapter, which I co-authored with Janice Stein, looking at the Cold War as a non-linear confluence and what we could learn about causation from it, and I'll come to some of those issues. And a final substantive chapter by Richard Herman that argues against the triumphalist interpretation of the Cold War and argues for a much more nuanced understanding of why it ended. Now, in turning our authors loose with these case studies, there were several other caveats and procedures that we set in place. The first was to encourage them to recognize that none of these explanations can be understood divorced from the day-to-day process of interaction of the parties involved. I mean, one of the problems with theories of politics is that they're so often context-free, and yet process often determines everything. People at any level of interaction start with a set of goals and strategies or behaviors that they think will lead to those goals. Well, this depends on judgments they make about how other people respond. When lots of people are involved, the outcome may be different from anybody's goal or what anybody envisaged would happen. So process becomes an important independent variable in its own, and it's often not recognized as such. One of the striking findings that we had in interviewing high-level diplomats in the U.S., the Soviet Union, and both Western and Eastern Europe who took part in various talks and negotiations that led to the end of the Cold War was their almost unanimous belief that the specific outcome that came about was inevitable. I mean, it was striking how they all believed this. And at the same time, every single one of them told us that if it weren't for the way they and their counterparts behaved in a particular negotiation, that this particular piece of the puzzle never would have fallen into place. So there was an enormous dissonance between what they told us and what they told us. And anybody who is a psychologist, and here I'll put my hat on as a psychologist, recognizes the power of the hindsight bias. As Baruch Fischhoff demonstrated some years ago in 1974, that when people are asked to estimate the probability of an outcome, once the outcome happens, they upgrade the probability and do it even in cases where they haven't been asked to do this. And think about a great event like the end of the Cold War, the French Revolution, the fall of the Roman Empire. How do historians make their reputations? And I see we have several in the room. They write accounts of what caused these events. How does the second historian make her reputation? Well, by offering another explanation for why it happened. After a while, you have 20 to 50 explanations for why these events occurred. So they appear all the more inevitable in retrospect. I mean, if you think about the explanations for the end of the Cold War, you could make a list of them, group them in eight or so different categories, and you could say, well, even if you could disprove five or six of these, it would still be a massively overdetermined event. So in retrospect, the more it's studied, the more inevitable it appears. Yet when you look at it from a fine-grained way and you talk to people about specific events, all the contingency and uncertainty emerges. And this is a powerful reason not only why we need to study process in reconstructing these events, but why we need to introduce counterfactuals. It's a fancy word, and what it really means is, what if? What if this had happened instead of that? What if Napoleon had stealth bombers at Waterloo? Or if Cleopatra had an ugly nose? How would the world be different? Now, we need to distinguish between miracle counterfactuals like stealth bombers at Waterloo and minimal rewrite counterfactuals. What if Hinckley's bullet had been 1 millimeter to the right? George Bush would have been president. George Bush, when he became president, basically toward the end of the Cold War, after 2 terms of Reagan, still didn't believe or wasn't sure whether Gorbachev was sincere. And he wanted to go slowly and slow things down. You know, he forgot Groucho Marx's great remark on this subject. I mean, this is the Marx brother whom I like to quote, always be sincere whether you mean it or not. And Gorbachev, as we now know, meant it. So these small changes could be very important, and by asking these counterfactual questions, it's the only way we can get a take on the nature of causation, because we can't do what you can do in some statistical studies, which is to have a large number of independent cases that are fully comparable, on which you have adequate variation in both the dependent and independent variables, causes and outcomes, and then look at what happens and run a regression equation and control for counterfactuals. If we're looking at one case like the end of the Cold War and we say X caused Y, that means ceteris paribus, no X, no Y. How do we know that? We don't. It's very hard, and we have to probe through counterfactual experiments done in a very controlled way to try to ascertain what's going on here at other levels of causation. And one of the chapters in the book, the one I've written with George Breslauer, in fact does this with respect to leaders. We ask ourselves, what would have happened with a different set of leaders? And through minimal rewrites, we do away with Gorbachev and Reagan, slip of the tongue, and we come up with other leaders. And we then looked at the kinds of strategies they might have pursued. We had a range of strategies that ranged from wait and see, extend the olive branch, become a little bit aggressive to test and probe the other side, and become very aggressive. We associated different policies with different leaders and then actually went and interviewed the ones that were alive and their advisors, if they weren't, to talk to them to see how they might have played the first set of events that would have happened when they were in power. And we found we had an array of strategies. We played them off against each other to see the kinds of outcomes we might have expected. Like one of these children's books, my granddaughter's currently doing this now. She has a column down one side that has the names of objects or pictures of them and colors on the other, and you have to draw the lines to connect. And we discovered, depending on who was in power, that you could have had a diverse set of outcomes by the early 90s. You could have had an earlier resolution of the Cold War that might have allowed the Soviet Union to survive as a state and possibly even an independent East Germany. Two, at the other end of the spectrum, you could have moved through a strategy of kinder and gentler Brezhnevism that would have kept the Cold War alive, although not acute, with the Berlin Wall, God help us, still standing, to more acute confrontation arising over a whole series of issues. So these outcomes were highly contingent on both leaders and both context. And one of the things we do in the early chapters of the book is to change context, and in the chapter with Breslauer, to change leaders, to get some sense of what you have to mutate to begin to get different kinds of answers. And even if you think that some end of the Cold War was ultimately inevitable because of the declining power of the Soviet Union, that doesn't mean that we would have had the particular end of the Cold War we had or when we had it, or that that outcome would have been as peaceful as it was, or that the Soviet Union had to collapse. All of these outcomes need to be disaggregated from the broader outcome of the end of the Cold War, and counterfactuals, at the very least, help us work through this problem conceptually. Now, the final question here, or were there two, was path dependency. As Marx says, leaders are important and we make choices about the world, but those choices are limited very much by the kind of context we face. So what's happened before both pushes us in certain directions and limits what can happen in the future. If you think about path dependency with respect to the Cold War, it's obvious in both micro and macro ways that it was path dependent. Think about Gorbachev's reforms. Why did they happen the way they did? They were very clearly a response to the stasis under Brezhnev of doing nothing after his strategy of détente, which was really efforts to get Western recognition and Western technology, had failed. Gorbachev and his advisors felt that far more dramatic measures were needed to jumpstart the Soviet economy and to change things at home. Why had Brezhnev, in full recognition of Soviet economic problems in the long term, pursued such a, half-hearted attempt to deal with those policies? Well, that was because of what he had learned from the Khrushchev experiments, where Khrushchev's more radical efforts at reform threatened the very survival of the Soviet Union and of Eastern Europe, in their view. So you have cycle and response, or action and response. To understand Gorbachev, you need to understand Brezhnev. To understand Brezhnev, you need to understand Khrushchev. In a broader sense, if you look at Soviet and American policy in the Cold War, they're a response to the lessons of World War II, America's fear of a nuclear Pearl Harbor, the Soviet Union's fear of another German invasion, leading it to extend its defensive glacis as deeply into Eastern Europe as it could, and the United States to do everything it could to prevent a kind of nuclear Pearl Harbor. Well, those policies also rested on the understanding of how appeasement had so miserably failed in the 1930s. But why was Hitler appeased in the 1930s? A good part of the reason, at least, was the lessons that historians and politicians had learned from 1914, that too aggressive policies of deterrence and armaments had provoked German aggression, that the counterfactual of perhaps accommodation would have worked was tried against Hitler where it didn't work, and then hardline policies were tried against post-Stalinist leaders where they ended up, I've argued in another book, provoking the very kind of behavior they were designed to prevent. So path dependency is very important for understanding the Cold War and its end. And finally, we need evidence. In this project, we worked together with the Cold War History Project to produce volumes of new evidence from recently unclassified documents on the Soviet and American side, and organized four conferences ourselves, one of them together with the Watson Institute at Brown, the others with the Geschwister-Scholl Institute and the Cold War Archive. The most interesting of these was in Moscow, where we brought together all of the surviving leaders of the attempted coup against Gorbachev. And it was fascinating just to sit in the room with these people, the former head of the KGB, Marshal Akhromiev, the head of the Soviet Army at the time, the chief head of the Communist Party, who was sitting there in a $1,000 Italian silk suit with a bodyguard carrying an attaché case, which was sitting on the table of the conference. And all of us were looking out of the corner of our eye at this attaché case, wondering what was inside. At about 2 in the afternoon, a mobile phone inside went off. And the fellow looked and was very embarrassed about what to do. And finally, the former head of the party nodded to him. He opened it up. Inside there was, of course, a telephone, but also wads of $100 bills in rubber bands and a very mean-looking revolver. I mean, something out of a bad movie. And what was fascinating about this meeting as well was the argument that broke out between Akhromiev and Yazov, former head of the secret police, over their failure to deal adequately with Yeltsin and the students that had turned out in defense of Gorbachev. Akhromiev had sent the soldiers on the streets unarmed because he didn't want any violence. And when the KGB reported that the coup was failing and they had to fire on the demonstrators, he made the decision not to issue any ammunition, saying he had not fought his way through the Great Patriotic War and served his country for 50 years to fire on Soviet citizens. He would rather see the coup fail. And to this day, the tensions about the resolution of that issue divided these people. It turns out that they had no plan what they were going to do when they got into office. The coup was triggered, they told us, by the All-Union Treaty, which would have allowed Soviet republics to keep recruits on their own territory. If this happened, they recognized there could be no Soviet army. In the absence of a Soviet army, there could be no Soviet state. So they had to do something, but they never thought what they were going to do beyond revoking that treaty. George Breslauer asked them, well, what would happen if Ukraine and Georgia said, we don't recognize you as legitimate rulers? What plans did you have? And they said, well, it never occurred to them that they wouldn't be recognized once they were in control of Moscow. I'm going to come back to this because it brings home the irrationality and lack of planning that characterize so much of policy on both sides in the end of the Cold War, and how easy it is, in retrospect, to see things as the result of rational plans and designs. This is a great mistake. Now, we had these conferences, and we wrote up chapters and exchanged them, and I'd like to share with you, not in detail, the particular stories associated with these turning points. I'll be glad to do that in the question and answer period, but in the 10 minutes that remain, I really want to address the conceptual lessons that emerge from this, and I may even need 15 minutes if that's possible. The first of these is that our authors found it very difficult to define in a clear way the boundaries of their respective four approaches, because they all tended to shade into one another. And they could easily engage in games of leapfrog. For example, people who said that ideas ended the Cold War would meet the response from structural theorists that, well, those ideas were a response to the structural condition of the Soviet Union, to which the ideas people would respond by saying the Soviet Union's structural disarray and economic decline was a function of the command economy. That was something that grew out of Marxist theory. It was an idea, to which the materialist explanation people would say, no, remember the Gershenkron thesis. The Soviet Union had to have a state-centric policy of control because it was a late industrializer. So we disallowed any leapfrogging in our theories or in our practice, and what we ended up with was a divide, with most people coming out in favor of ideas as the central underlying explanation for changes in all of the turning points, but with a recognition that ideas were totally inadequate to explain what happened, that you had to take into account, to some extent, material capabilities, but also domestic politics, leaders, and pure accident. What was interesting in the contest between those who supported ideas and material claims was the better arguments, I thought, that the people invoking ideas in domestic politics could make. Because if you're invoking a structural explanation, as, for example, James Davis and Wolforth did for explaining the unification of Germany, the assumption is that a certain structural condition determines a policy choice. So there's a chain of logic linking something that you observe in the strategic environment to a policy that you observe. Well, that may not be how leaders themselves observe it, and to make your case, you need to come up with some kind of smoking gun in the form of evidence that says Gorbachev and his advisors understood the structural imperative the same way that you did, and there's evidence that that's why they made their decision. In none of these turning points could any of the authors come up with such smoking guns. So the structural explanation remained one entirely of logical inference, not one of evidence. Whereas the ideas and domestic politics explanation was rich in evidential support. That there were discussions among leaders, Politburo notes, notes made by individual members of conversations in which people talked about the reasons why they were making these decisions, and frequently did so in ideational terms or with respect to the configuration of domestic or alliance politics. The leader's explanation, we all agreed, was important, but ultimately that was sustained by counterfactuals of who else would have done it differently. And that, of course, is an argument that is, again, a logical chain based on assumptions, but carried out in the absence of evidence. We found, as I noted, that no single explanation was compelling for any one of the turning points. Rather, most authors tended to distinguish between what they thought were underlying causes and enabling causes. And most saw a combination of ideas and material conditions as underlying and the other factors as enabling. I mean, case in point, had the Soviet Union been prospering economically, it seems unlikely they would have picked somebody to be a leader who was avowedly reformist. Gorbachev was picked with no idea of how far he would go. Gorbachev had no idea of how far he would go. His policies worked out through a series of experiments which allowed him more space at home to carry out more experiments at home and abroad. And in part, that depended on the constellation of domestic politics and how he played it out. So all of these things came together in a package. And one of the things the authors do in their chapters is to unpack that ball of wax, if you will, to show the different ways in which these explanations interacted with each other and at what stage some of them became important. And that then allowed a higher level of generalization about causation in the Cold War. We also found that we had to situate our arguments in a broader historical perspective. For example, Archie Brown and others thought that new thinking was a terribly important outcome. Well, where did new thinking originate? If it wasn't just a response to structural conditions, and it wasn't because the people who described new thinking and ideas more generally as so critical in bringing about changes all trace them to before the Soviet Union's serious economic problems were recognized, and had to go back to deeper levels of history and politics to find explanations for it. Jacques Lévesque, who wrote the chapter on Eastern Europe, argued that the end of the Cold War should really be seen as a triumph of socialist revisionism. That it wasn't the collapse of communism in the Soviet Union that led to its collapse in Eastern Europe, but rather the success of socialism in Western Europe, of revisionist socialism, of bringing about a far better life for workers, integrating them in the politics, economy, and culture of their countries, that so impressed Gorbachev and leaders like Dubček in Eastern Europe that Gorbachev and those around him, like Shevardnadze and others, were deeply imbued with this vision and very much impressed in their conversations with French and Italian communist leaders that something like this could be achieved in the Soviet Union as well. To the extent this is so, it's an argument rooted in a liberal explanation, and one has to go look at an entirely different set of phenomena to perhaps explain in the deepest sense the end of the Cold War and the changes of ideas in the Soviet Union that led to it. Finally, we have synergism here, which is terribly important, and we can think about synergism in two ways, and if anybody's interested, I can send you the chapter on this. I really only have time to gloss over it in the most superficial way. You can think of synergism as A plus B plus C plus D plus E all combines to bring about an outcome. And synergism means that possibly one or a couple of these things together could have brought about the outcome, but all of them together really did it in an important way. Think about, in my country, there was a problem with Ford Explorers together with tires from Firestone. Firestone tires were defective. They were put on Ford Explorers, which had high centers of gravity. They were underinflated because that was the instruction given out by Ford, and lots of them were driven on hot roads in the Southwest. All of those factors combined led to blowouts, rollover, and deaths. Okay? And if you take away any one of the factors, you still have the phenomenon. It's just not as pronounced. And some of our authors explain the end of the Cold War in terms of this kind of multi-causality. But there's another notion of confluence, which completely confounds linear notions of causation. Think about a house that goes up in smoke because a couple has lit a candle in their windowsill, which lots of people do in the Christmas season. They've gone out for dinner. They forgot to change the battery in their smoke alarm. It's an old house whose window hasn't been successfully caulked. The breeze comes through, blows the curtain against the flame. It catches fire, and nobody recognizes it because of the absence of the fire alarm until it's too late to save the house. What caused the fire? It's obviously a confluence that probably couldn't have happened in the absence of any of the steps. And at the other end of the spectrum, we have authors who are making the case that this is how the Cold War ended, and authors that make the case that it was something in between. If you're more interested in this and the implications that arise from it for multi-causality, please have a look at the chapter that Janice Stein and I wrote. Well, where does this leave us? It leaves us with several conclusions, and I'm going to take 5 minutes to do this. The first is that Reagan and Gorbachev had little idea of what they were getting into when they got into it. And it's not altogether clear on Gorbachev's side that if he could wind the tape back and do it over again, he would have. It worked out very differently than what he expected. And we have to take this into account when we attempt to understand what happened. Process depended, in the first instance, on a degree of trust that developed between the two men. And here, personality was enormously important. I really believe that Ronald Reagan is a visual personality, and please ask me a question. I'm priming you about this in the question and answer period because I have a wonderful story about it from my days in the CIA. And what do we know as cognitive psychologists? That people who have elaborate, well-developed schemas are very insensitive to information that challenges them. They explain it away, distort it, somehow make it consistent with what they believe. People who have very simple and underdeveloped schemas may change them in response to new information. Well, Ronald Reagan, not as much as George W., but Ronald Reagan had a very underdeveloped schema. And when he discovered that Gorbachev didn't have horns, but in fact was really quite a nice guy, it created enormous dissonance. And what he did was to bring his picture of the Soviet Union in line with his picture of its leader. Whereas everybody else advising him, including George Bush Sr., brought their understanding of Gorbachev in line with their view of the Soviet Union and kept explaining away everything that Gorbachev did. There was lots of information that gradually emerged from meetings and from the consequences of one's own action that led to rethinking. Not necessarily rational rethinking, but rethinking as things evolved. There was enormous miscalculation, and I want to tell two stories about miscalculation and the end of the Cold War because you can't understand it otherwise. My favorite one is Gorbachev. Janice Stein and I sat in his office having tea with him in June of 1989. And all he really wanted to talk about was Tiananmen. He had just come back from a visit. It was when the demonstrators were still in the square. He wanted to know if it could happen here, and meaning Moscow. We talked about that, and all we wanted to talk about was the Balkans. Excuse me, not the Balkans, the Baltic states, because this is where nationalism and nationalist movements were surfacing. And the Soviets seemed sort of blind to what was going on. Gorbachev and Vadim Zagladin, who was sitting there, his chief advisor for the Baltics, said, not to worry. Nothing's going to happen. Why? We know the men who are the spokesmen. They know just how far they can go. We speak to them on the telephone all the time. Well, Janice and I didn't say anything, but we came away afterwards, and they said, they're crazy. I mean, once these kinds of national forces are unleashed, they're going to get out of control. And leaders who don't pick it up and go running with it are going to be left behind by others who are more demanding and more extremist and more nationalist. And this is precisely what happened. I theorize that Soviet leaders, on the whole, those around Gorbachev, had no idea about what would happen once they opened the tap of democracy in the Soviet Union. They thought it was a tap, that they could turn it on and turn it off and control it. But in fact, they couldn't. And things got out of control. And in the end, they were following, not leading. And they had to catch up and adjust to what was going on in the Soviet Union, in Eastern Europe, and finally in Germany. They totally lost control over events because we, coming from democratic societies, had a deeper understanding of this. They, at most, had read textbooks, or in the case of Shevardnadze, had observed Canada. On the American side, think about arms control. Reykjavik was Gorbachev's great arms control initiative. He, in fact, initially asked Ogarkov and Akromeyev to come up with a proposal for arms control because he wanted to do away with the nuclear threat. They told him that they would do this, and they came up with a proposal for very limited cuts, thinking that this would take years to negotiate, and then, of course, there was always the verification issues. Gorbachev didn't realize the extent he was suckered by them, was very unhappy, and decided to reject their advice and make this dramatic proposal, which he came up with basically on his own, without any Politburo approval, for doing away with all nuclear weapons. Ronald Reagan was very responsive to this at Reykjavik and had to be pulled back by his handlers. Reagan's own view of doing something about it and public support for it in the United States and Europe compelled the Reagan administration to act. So they sat down and decided, what can we do? This is a public relations problem we need to solve. They came up with the double zero proposal, remember, on the assumption that this was a sure thing. The Soviets would reject it out of hand. And they would be tarred with the brush of turning down arms control because it was so unfavorable to them in terms of the relative balance of forces in Eastern Europe. They were stunned when Gorbachev accepted it, and they had no choice but to go along. And of course, Gorbachev was reacting differently because he didn't care about tactical advantage or disadvantage. He wanted to jumpstart an end to the Cold War by changing public opinion in the West, lighting a fire under them, having them compel Western leaders, but particularly Reagan and Bush, to meet him halfway. And this worked. And finally, Gorbachev himself engaged in motivated bias. I've written about crisis, arguing that motivated bias, when leaders believe they have to do things for political reasons, leads them to discount the credibility of their adversaries to do things which lead to very serious crises and sometimes to wars. Gorbachev's behavior and Sadat's earlier indicates that motivated bias may play an enormously positive role in ending conflicts. Gorbachev took all these great risks without any real evidence that Reagan would reciprocate. He convinced himself, in the absence of evidence, that Reagan would. Why? Because Gorbachev recognized that his big commitment was reforming the Soviet Union economically and domestically. He could only do that if the Cold War ended. He had to have an end to the Cold War. He convinced himself, therefore, he could end the Cold War through these unilateral gestures. He also convinced himself that his great opponents, hardliners allied with all those leaders in communist states in Eastern Europe, could be overcome by encouraging reform in Eastern Europe, that everywhere they would bring little Gorbachevs to power. And instead, we know they brought anti-communists to power and brought an end to communism in Eastern Europe. So from every perspective, there was miscalculation, bungling, some cleverness, process that brought about changes that nobody envisaged. And to understand the end of the Cold War, we have to step back and look at these small stories and see what they say in a conceptual sense about how these big events prevail. And the obvious lesson is that simple theories at any level are very clearly wrong, that the real goal for IR theory is to bridge to history, find ways in which theory may offer first cuts, but context, people, and accidents are ultimately determining in how the world works. Thank you very much.
If I just give people a couple of minutes just to sit, to leave, or, and then we'll move to the Q&A. If people are leaving, if they could, then let's water that by now. Okay. We're going to have about 15 minutes of a Q&A, so if, okay, if you could actually, rapid departure, clear exit strategy. Okay. Okay, that's as... All right, well, let's just take some of the... there's a number of people now have already got their hands up. Where are the microphones?
Ask them to say who they are.
Yeah, yeah, please. If you could just come to the front. I'll take two at the front straight away. I'll start with the gentleman here. If you could use the microphone. And then, is it on? Turn the mic on, will you?
I went to Moscow in 1984, April, together with Mr. MacArthur, who is a man who...
You've got to speak louder into that mic.
Who is handed over the Roosevelt letter just before the war to Stalin. And he was ambassador and State Department diplomat. And I think there must have been some kind of Western initiative or American side initiative to end of the Cold War. The reason why I'm saying is 1984 November, I went to the Prime Minister's Office of Japan together with my father, and he is was going to see Mr. Reagan 10 days after. And on that occasion, my father talked with Mr. Nakasone. This is a good time to have some initiative to end of Cold War, and you should talk to Mr. Nakasone. So this was a kind of, there must have been some kind, that was rather overlooked to analyze this Cold War, I mean, initiative from the West side or American side.
Right, the question is, to what extent did American initiatives play a role in ending the Cold War?
Now, let me just tell you another question first. Please.
Oh, I apologize.
That's okay. Please.
You made a convincing case, I think.
Speak into the mic.
Right into the mic, please.
You made a convincing case by describing the transition of the Soviet Union as a series of experiments without knowing which way they would go. Well, if you compare the transition of the Soviet Union to the transition in China, it seems that there are some fundamental differences. Would you like to comment on this causation, if you like? I mean, why the Chinese experiment seem to work better, at least for up to now.
Okay, thanks very much. Take those two first notes, please. Thanks.
Let me take those first. The first question is really about the role of U.S. initiatives in ending the Cold War. As you know, there are some people who claim that Reagan ended the Cold War. Jack Matlock...
you got to keep that mic.
No, it just went dead. There it is. Jack Matlock has written a book about this, basically arguing that he ended the Cold War. It's remarkable in its arrogance. But attributing it to an initiative that Reagan took in 1984 whose document he wrote, which was then delivered to Moscow. The Reagan was interested in making some progress, but the Reagan initiative was a very loose, ill-defined one. Gorbachev took that as encouragement to believe that his own initiatives might get someplace, but he was in the process of getting ready to make them in any case, and nothing happened. This was 1984. Nothing really happened until after Gorbachev was in power and began to consolidate his power. So the Reagan role here has been greatly oversold, and I also argue that Star Wars, rather than ending the Cold War, in fact prolonged it and made it more difficult to reach an agreement. The second issue is a very interesting one, the Chinese response as opposed to the Soviet one. I have two things to say here. The first is, again, it highlights the importance of path dependency. The Chinese believe that they've learned from the Soviet failure, that encouraging political reform leads to dissolution, remaining firm with politics while bringing about economic reform, they believe, will work. I believe they're only buying time, that Chinese communism is going into the dustbin of history, that the changes that are coming about are going to lead to the demise of the Communist Party sooner or later, and what happens in China is, at that point, anybody's guess. I'm not a Chinese specialist. What is interesting is how path dependency works. Because prior to, let me give you another case. And I just keeps bouncing. Maybe this will be better. Prior to, is that better? Not much. Prior to the, does that work upstairs? Prior to the unification of Germany, India was committed to the unification of the subcontinent and South Korea to the unification of the Korean Peninsula. All their policies were designed at undermining their adversary. But what happened? Everybody saw. Yeah, but it bounces and makes these terrible noises. All right, let's try it. See if that works again. What happened was the German experiment has been a mixed success. It's cost an enormous amount of money. It's led to great dislocation. And it led the Indians to completely, and South Koreans, to rethink their policies. And they're now at least as much designed as keeping their opponents propped up as they are bringing them down. And imagine if North Korea had collapsed first, perhaps the Germans would have pursued a different policy in the end of the Cold War. So path dependency, it just makes terrible noise. Path dependency is very important.
Okay. There's a question up the top here. Chap with the big long right arm. That's you. I know him well. Goodbye.
I'm not offering going back to a monocausal explanation, because I think your explanation of the interaction of the sets of causes was very important, but it nevertheless seemed that most of them seem to occur within and about the Soviet Union. So I was wondering to what extent what you're discussing here is actually more the end of the Soviet Union, and in the sense that we might see at the end of the end of the Cold War as a byproduct of the end of the Soviet Union.
I'll take that one, and then I want another question in the middle from the chap in the white shirt, please. And then we could bring the mic down here for the third question, take a set of three. Please.
Seeing as we're indulging in counterfactualism, how do you think the end of the Cold War and the Soviet Union would have been different if Gorbachev had come to power earlier in the 1980s?
Right, that's a Neil Ferguson question, that one. All right, please.
I'm just wondering if there are any echoes from the Cold War in today's war on terror, or any factors from the end of the Cold War that have helped to lead us to where we are today. And secondly, if that's not a good question,
about it's a very good question.
Unpopularity at home, which I'm really confused about.
Whose unpopularity at home?
Gorbachev.
Oh, Gorbachev's, yeah. Okay, there's a number there. Do you want to pick up on those three?
Sure, that would be fine. The Cold War versus the end of the USSR. I really view it the other way. I think it is the end of the Cold War. And clearly, you could have had an end of the Cold War earlier that would have allowed the Soviet Union to continue. Indeed, I'll offer the counterfactual that in the absence of the coup and Yeltsin's rivalry with Gorbachev that led him to basically proclaim the independence of Russia, it's possible something like the Soviet Union could have survived. This connects as well to the Gorbachev question. Imagine a Gorbachev coming to power in the 1980s when Jimmy Carter was in power. In that circumstance, you would not have had an invasion of Afghanistan. Carter was the president who desperately wanted to extend the olive branch and reach an accommodation with the Soviet Union. A Gorbachev-Carter combination had all kinds of potential for leading to a very different set of outcomes than the ones we got 10 years later. The war on terror and Gorby at home. Let's do Gorby at home, because that's more easily addressed. Gorbachev at home is seen as a traitor, a sellout, a fool by a large percentage of Russian opinion, who sees the end of the Cold War as, in the same way as the right wing in the West does, as a unilateral triumph of the United States, as an expression of aggressive American policy, which continues through the incorporation of Eastern states into NATO, and all designed to reduce the power of Russia and the Soviet Union. They see Gorbachev as either the witting, if they're really nasty, or if they're nicer, the unwitting a dupe or accomplice who allowed this to happen. And this is more and more a widespread perception within Russia. So there's no love whatsoever for Gorbachev. Now, the war on terror, I would argue that throughout the Cold War, the U.S. confirmed tautologically unsuccessful policies, particularly deterrence, coercive diplomacy, the belief that hardline and the use of force pays off. These beliefs are underlying assumptions that contributed to the war in Iraq, and of course end up again becoming partially self-fulfilling, because to the extent that they make the United States isolated and the result of and provoke more violence against it or Americans, they seem to create the need for ever more force and coercive diplomacy. It's a terrible policy, and one which Americans and the American national security establishment has not escaped from. And by the way, these views were equally shared, I believe, by Kerry's foreign policy advisors. So this is one of the problems of social policy, that if you're committed to a belief and you act on it, you often generate information, especially in a murky world, that appears to you and others to confirm it, which strengthens the hold on your mind. So this, to me, is very central to the war on terrorism. Something that's different and novel, I think, is the extent to which the Bush administration hijacked 9/11 for their own partisan political purposes. There was a moment when Americans were united, and united in a positive kind of way. I think, and I'm going to talk 2 minutes about this because I think it's important and I haven't heard other people talking about it. Take, for example, black-white relations in the United States. They really suffered a tremendous setback with the O.J. Simpson trial. I remember being in Pittsburgh at the Graduate School of Public and International Affairs when the verdict was announced on television, and there were 50 of us watching, about 20 blacks and roughly 30 whites, and few in-betweens. The blacks started cheering. The whites were silent, and their jaws dropped. The blacks noticed what was happening on the whites' faces and stopped cheering, and the two groups looked at each other and quietly walked off and never really talked about it. I had one black friend with whom I could talk about O.J. Simpson. And it was clear what had happened. For blacks, hey, a black man had finally beaten the system that had been oppressing them for centuries. That was what was important and grounds for celebration. O.J. gave it to them. For the whites, a guy who was clearly guilty of a double murder had beaten the rap. Huh? Different framing. Watching on television what happened at 9/11 with blacks and whites risking their lives to rescue each other, it bridged that divide. It even bridged the dislike of New York City for the rest of the nation, and that's even greater than the racial divide. As an aside, I always define my nationality not as an American, but as a New Yorker. America came together. It was hijacked by the administration. They continue to hijack it. They fed the country with a series of lies. The public opinion polls on the eve of the election indicated that 75% of supporters, of people who were going to vote for Bush, believed that Saddam was implicated one way or another in 9/11. The country has become divided, as we know, and it's not a red-blue divide. It's an urban-rural divide more than anything else. If you list states by their percentage of urban population, the top 20 are blue, the bottom 20 are red, and the others between them are split. And that divide has profound consequences for the politics and culture of the United States, which can be very destructive in the long term.
Thanks very much. There's a question here, the chap in the blue shirt, please. Where's the mic? Thanks very much. Is anybody up? And then there's a question, the chap here. Thanks. Great. Thank you very much. And I'll take two together. Please, thank you.
Yeah, I don't think you give enough credit to Ronald Reagan. I remember when he was president. And early on, he said Marxism-Leninism would end up on the ash heap of history. And I thought that was quite a twist, because instead of containment of Soviet communism, he basically called for the destruction of Soviet communism. I wonder if how you would talk about that. And also, on the same vein, Eastern European leaders and people even today, I think, are quite pro-American, the new EU states, because they believe that Ronald Reagan destroyed the Soviet Union and freed them. And I wonder if you could respond to that.
Thank you very much. And there's a question here from the gentleman here, please.
Yeah, I just would like to know in what context we could see the resumption of the Cold War in our own lifetime. Just before I came here, the BBC quoted President Putin as saying that Russia can penetrate any shield that America would build around itself. And so there's a kind of some sort, we see some sort of suspicion vis-a-vis Putin today in the West. Can you elaborate on that? And so, just back on the resumption of the Cold War, would that be based on, say, for instance, the control of strategic natural and mineral resources in the developing world, in the third world, like from country rich in mineral, like Congo and many others? Thank you.
Thank you very much. There's two questions there, Ned.
Okay.
Thank you.
Let me come to Ronald Reagan and the end of the Cold War. There are some people who also believe in Santa Claus. Ronald Reagan, indeed, did mouth all kinds of rhetoric, some of it quite confrontational. The effect of that was to frighten the Soviets, to strengthen hardliners in the Soviet Union, to make it more difficult for Gorbachev to find the political space to act. Had Reagan been more conciliatory or just kept his big mouth shut for much of the time, Gorbachev's initiatives would have come even sooner. So there really is no evidence on the Soviet side that Reagan did much of anything that was positive until Reykjavik. Now, post-Reykjavik, you were dealing with a very different Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan was like the month of March in New England. And we say that March comes in like a lion and goes out like a lamb. Ronald Reagan was the biggest hawk, or among the biggest hawks, in his first administration. By the end of that administration, he was its biggest dove. And it was the switch to the dovishness that made him a partner of Gorbachev and helped bring about the end of the Cold War. It wasn't Star Wars. It wasn't the expenditure on it. It was the trust that developed between the two men that created the space for Gorbachev to introduce changes at home and abroad. The resumption of the Cold War, there's a yes and a no. It's, I think, certainly true that there is a very real possibility that Russian-American tensions could dramatically increase, both by virtue of Bush's policies and Putin's policies. Neither of them are Democrats, small d, in my view, and both of them have behaved in irresponsible ways. That said, the situation is so different today, and this will be my tilt to power, the power balance between them so different, that there's nothing in it for the for Russia to engage in a new Cold War, nor for the United States. Russia's primary concerns, and it's very much in Putin's minds, are in the near abroad, the Russian periphery. And that's where he has to be concerned. As long as the United States doesn't do things in the near abroad that really make the Russians feel very threatened, it's unlikely there's going to be a renewal of a Cold War. In fact, Putin's reference to strategic forces and the ability to break through an American defense are designed to highlight the one thing the Russians have that still makes them something of a major power, and that is, of course, strategic nuclear force. So we have to be careful from separating the rhetoric from the practice. That said, if I look at both the Middle East and the Russian-American relations, I'd argue that there are four retrograde disastrous leaders: Bush and Putin, Sharon and Arafat. Thank God one of them is gone.
Don't sit on the fence. There's one question there. Yeah. That's why, and one question there. Please, sir.
I think my question might just relate to what you just said. Anatole Levin gave a lecture in this series earlier, and in that he, and also in his book, particularly in his book, he talks a lot about the role of the American nationalism. Looking forward, what do you see? Do you agree with his analysis of the negative role of American nationalism, the defensive nationalism, particularly in the context of Middle East, combined with what he describes as sort of a chauvinist nationalism in Israel? And just want to just add to that quickly that we've been talking about Cold War as a bad thing, I assume, and it is, of course, in a lot of ways. But a lot of people in the Middle East, I think, would wish for some sort of Cold War arising. And can you see anything that might slow down the sort of what people in the Middle East would see as sort of rampant militarism coming from the U.S.?
Yeah, could the Cold War in that sense limited American reach because the Soviet Union was still the Soviet Union? Yeah.
Yes. How many more million people are going to get killed there? I don't know.
Okay, fine. There was another question over here. Yeah, gentleman in the middle there, please.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, be brief. Thanks.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Good then. You mentioned a counterfactual argument where the Soviet Union can persist as a state and the end of the Cold War still comes about. Does this imply that the Soviet Union, given its economic woes, gives up Soviet communism? And what does that mean for the conflict between ideas? If they don't give up communism, can the Cold War really end? And what does it say about bipolarity? And if the Soviet Union did persist, what would that mean for the United States' strategies today, and would we have been allowed to go into Iraq in the same fashion, or would the USSR have been able to stop the United States? And if you've got a story about the CIA, I'm sure we'd love to hear it.
That's enough.
Plausible deniability, I think, on this one. Yes, please, sir. Yeah. Last one.
Yes, thank you. I would also have asked for the CIA story, and I have another one.
Were you in the CIA as well?
No, I just like to hear the story.
Tell that long hair, the CIA is changing its image.
I don't know. Anyway, talking of the power of ideas to change history and to change the outcomes, and also taking into account your analysis that it is not so much the United States that won the Cold War, but more or less, kind of part of Russian politics being successful, part of them being unsuccessful. There is still a very widespread belief, as you lined out, that it is the United States, not only the United States, but also in Russia, who won this war. And I would ask you whether the, the materialist structure in Russia, which is the collapse of the economy, made this persistence of this idea, which then became powerful, very very likely, and therefore materials also matter. Mm.
Okay, thanks very much. Okay.
Okay.
So this is your final pitch.
This almost asks for another lecture. Let me see if I can avoid doing that. I'm going to avoid doing it. Yeah, I'm already thinking of a drink, Mick. It's okay. I know you have the bottle under the table. Right.
I've actually been drinking vodka all the way through this, by the way. Go for it.
All right. American nationalism and the Middle East. There is no doubt that supporters of the Bush administration, their nationalism has been mobilized since 9/11. They've become more inward-looking, more hostile toward Europeans, reluctant to see that America requires multilateral policies to accomplish much of anything successfully. The long-term consequences of this, I don't have a crystal ball, but I can see two different scenarios. The first is that America becomes more unpredictable, more unilateral, more dangerous from everybody's perspective. The second is that this is a kind of passing stage that's going to lead, in the end, even to something positive. That the reason why Americans are so nationalist now is that they've discovered, a lot of them for the first time, that there are people out there who don't like them, who don't accept that their vision of political truth is universal and applicable to others, who criticize the United States for what they're doing, and who won't support it in doing a whole range of things. This is terribly threatening to Americans. This is a country that's not held together by Bluten Boden, by, you know, long-standing attachments to soil and ethnicity, but rather by an idea. That's what makes America Americans. And to think that this idea is threatened and that others are challenging it is much too threatening for a lot of people. So they're lashing out in anger, out of insecurity. To the extent to which they can get this out of their system in some ways, or at least have their children realize the negative consequences of behaving this way, which is exactly the kind of thing Gorbachev and his advisors learned in the Soviet Union, then there's some hope for a much more positive evolution and a more sophisticated American public opinion in the future. I'd like to think that that's the outcome that will prevail. With respect to winning and losing the Cold War, well, Janice Stein and I argued that we all lost the Cold War, that the expenditure of blood and treasure was, in the end, in nobody's interest. It was stupid, and we're paying a very large price. Now, certainly, those who argue for the power of material forces can argue from the liberal perspective that this is the triumph of democratic capitalism, from the Marxist perspective that this is simply the triumph of retrograde capitalism, and arguments can be made in support of both of those. I don't claim to have a truth, only a perspective. So I encourage you, if you have a different one, to make a good case for it. We'll all learn. Now, with respect to the Middle East, and then I'll close with the CIA, I find your statement one-sided. Yes, indeed, there's a lot of Israeli chauvinism, but boy, is there a lot of crazy Arab nationalism. There are two parties to this conflict, and presumably there are extremists and moderates in both sides, and it doesn't help to brand everybody on one side as an extremist. This is precisely the kind of thing that we did in the Cold War, and all it did was to strengthen hardliners on both sides. We need to be reaching out to moderates in both communities and looking for ways in which we can have accommodation. And I would imagine that there's some hope in a second Bush administration of some movement in the Middle East, and this is an area where the Europeans could play a very important role. In fact, Daniel Barenboim had a very nice op-ed piece in the Times the day before yesterday arguing the ways in which this might occur. And continuing this, the Cold War, yes, it did serve as a constraint in preventing superpower war, but Soviet and American support for opposing clients in the Middle East led to untold numbers of wars and deaths. It was hardly a peaceful period in the Middle East. So in the absence of the Cold War, we see we have new violence, and it's very easy to blame it all on the superpowers or the United States. I think to end this part of the talk with a quote from Shakespeare, "The fault, dear Brutus, may lie in ourselves." Now, my CIA story highlights the extent to which irrationality, accident, and chance often drives politics. I was an advisor to Admiral Stansfield Turner, who was Carter's director of the Central Intelligence Agency. I was a scholar in residence, that was my official title. He was appointed director after the excesses of the Nixon years to try to make the CIA a law-abiding institution and to clean up, stop the domestic spying and coups in Chile, this kind of thing that happened under Nixon and Kissinger, and to reform the analytical side of the agency, which was what I was working on. And how did things work? If you remember, in the early part of the administration, Alexander Haig was arguing that, yes, I don't want to see this in the newspaper, by the way. Alexander Haig was arguing that Soviet support of terrorism was worldwide, that the U.S. had to do something to stop it. The new director of the Central Intelligence Agency, Bill Casey, who was a Reagan associate, demanded that the agency produce a SNI, a Special National Intelligence Estimate, on Soviet support of terrorism. Why? In the last few presidents, the CIA wasn't in the action channels because it was telling the president things he didn't want to hear. Casey figured, now we can get back in the action channels, increase the power of the agency, and I'll look good within the agency. Well, he gave it to three analysts to work on, two of them Latin American specialists, and they concluded that there was no support for Soviet support of terrorist groups, that at most the Soviets had some distant relations with some of the political fronts. Casey called them in. He said, "I pay you," expletive deleted, $60,000 a year, and you can't tell me what's in here. And he picked up a book by Claire Sterling, a British journalist.
Great book.
Called something like Terror
Internet. Terror Network.
Terror Network. And he said, "She knows more about Soviet support of terrorism than you do. I want you to go out and don't come back here until you know more about her sources than she does." Well, they researched this, and they found out that most of her sources were planted on her by the CIA. That there were three young men on the operational side who had come up with a campaign to tar the Soviets with the brush of terrorism. And through a cutout, they had placed the stuff on her, and she, being an ideologue, didn't ask where they came from. So they made another appointment with Casey and came back with the three of them, who confessed sheepishly to knowing much more about Claire Sterling's sources than she did. Casey said, "Good work, boys."
Good work.
However, the president wants the Soviets guilty of terrorism, and this is what we're going to tell him. The analyst said, "No way. We're a professional intelligence agency. It's our job to call it the way we see it." Casey relieved them of the job. He didn't punish them. Found three more pliant people to jiggle with the numbers and the language to give a report back to the White House that made it appear that the Soviets were doing what the White House said. So in a way, confirming again tautologically the beliefs of the White House. Everybody knew about this in the agency within hours, and people split, the lion's share being horrified by what was happening, and a minority being pleased because of the organizational benefits to the agency of doing this. Similar stories have come out of the agency during the Bush administration, and I must say, more of the people within the agency were defending, from what I've heard, the professional side of things. But once again, it was the higher-ups who were intent on telling the president what he wanted to hear because it played well for them. This is not an American problem. This is a problem endemic to bureaucracies and intelligence agencies worldwide. And unless you have leaders who are smart enough to realize the extent to which they become the prisoners of those who advise them, they live in narrower and narrower circles and make policy that's more and more removed from reality. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Just to thank Ned, thank you very much for coming along tonight. We've had over 2,000 people, actually, to this set of lectures so far, many more to come. Our final lecture for this term is by Professor John G. Eikenberry from Princeton University, formerly of